Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we've got a topic that not many of us are able to talk about, and that is, what does it take to become a billionaire? Not millionaire, but billionaire. Well, my guest today, who is Robert Jordan, has put together an absolutely fascinating piece of publication. It's titled How They Did It, Billion Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. Robert Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Donna.
I love talking with entrepreneurs. I think, of course, I'm sort of one myself anyway. It's wonderful to be an odd duck. I think that that's what entrepreneurs often are. They're people that have the capability of looking at things outside of the box and are not afraid to work hard at whatever needs to be done. Now, you, Robert, you've been growing and building companies for a lot of years. How did you recognize that you were of the entrepreneurial stuff?
It's a great question, Don. I just always, I was always thinking of things I wanted to do, and in my case, my first company was called Online Access. It was kind of like when a light bulb went off. A friend had bought a computer and a modem and didn't know who to call, and I thought, wow, there must be something here. Somebody ought to be reporting on things that are online. That was my first company.
Wow. So that started you off, but then you've gotten involved in wanting to help people build their businesses. Did you specifically orient yourself into just the high-tech industry? What else did you venture into?
Well, over the years, as I was building Online Access, I started meeting a lot of other people who were starting companies, and I just loved it. I loved the whole process of learning from them and helping coach people. After 10 years, I sold my first company, Online Access, and then I started a new company called Interim CEO, and all I wanted to do was projects for other entrepreneurs, and I've been doing that for about another 12 years.
Were they specifically oriented in particular modalities, or did you do everything from agriculture to high tech?
It tended to be technology because technology companies is where you have this fascinating challenge of how do you start with something, you know, from nothing, and where you have a possibility that you could build a business in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's a tougher thing when it comes to some traditional businesses. And it's nothing against those businesses, but I was really fascinated by this idea of how do you take something and just make it really big.
You have a quote by Howard Tolman, who was a six-time founder. And I'm going to read it. If you don't understand that it's a completely iterative process and that the name of the entrepreneurial game is successive approximation, not postponed perfection, you can easily become paralyzed. That's a mouthful of words.
Right. I think what he is getting at is this idea that you have to get in the game. And too many of us, we judge our efforts a little too harshly. We decide not to start things. And Howard's point was, you have to get in the game, not because it's going to be perfect, but because that's the only way you get presented with more and more opportunities to keep on improving and doing things better. It's always a game of approximation. It's not that anything is ever perfect.
Now, with your book, you did orient your interviews towards many individuals who are in one way or another associated with the high-tech industry. How did you define the individual? What were your parameters? Let me rephrase my question. What were your parameters for trying to do an interview with these people that were so very, very successful?
We set up a criteria, which was that an individual had to start from zero, start from scratch, launch, grow, and sell a company for $100 million or more, or go public for $300 million or more. Had to be technology, and we were looking at the heartland states. And that from that list of hundreds of companies, we interviewed 45 founders who created about $41 billion from scratch in terms of the value. Now, I should say one of those founders is from Groupon, and so now if I was putting the number on the book, I would say $63
billion. $63 billion. Let me ask you a question. We're in an economy that is very depressed at this time. That's my word. It's not recessed. It is depressed. We need innovation in the United States. We have been known for this. With most of these companies, did they situate their primary base in the United States, or did they outsource most of their work?
Most everything started in the U.S., and I have to tell you, I take heart from the fact that most of these businesses started in small towns, places that have nothing to do with Silicon Valley. And, for example, when we wrote the book, the number one founder in the book was Dane Miller. He had started a company called Biomet, which when we wrote it, it was about $12 billion in value. And he was making arm slings. This is slings, you know, when you break your arm.
Mm-hmm.
He moved into something a little more technologically advanced. He was one of the pioneers making artificial hips and knees. And he's the person, the reason why most of those materials are now made out of titanium is all because of Dane Miller. But he was in a little town, Warsaw, Indiana. He started there. He's still there. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to do this in Silicon Valley.
This is incredible. And that's one of the components that I find fascinating about your book. Bonnie Baskin, there's a quote that was written here, "The joy is the building of the business and its strategy and taking something that you have, repackaging it, and adding to it to be able to find another opportunity to grow." And that is exactly what you have described with Dane Miller. Let's talk about Jeff Aaron. Aaron, I think that's the way I'd pronounce it. I would look at this man and I would say, this is really an intriguing story. I love how people will take something that maybe nobody's doing anything with and expanding it. Tell us about Jeff Aaron and Ovation Pharmaceuticals. It's in Illinois. Tell us his story.
He is a fascinating guy. I'll tell you the first story about him, how he got into the pharmaceutical business. He was in college. His girlfriend, she wasn't really sick, but for some reason he had to go take her to the ER. And she was fine, but while he was in the ER, he started chatting with the doctors, and that led to a doctor introducing him to a pharmaceutical sales rep, one of the guys that sells drugs. And he asked the guy if he could just go around with him for the day. He just wanted to learn what was it like to be a sales rep in the pharmaceutical business, and that was how his entire career started. I thought that was just wonderful advice for anybody who's in college. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Jeff was in the business. He did a great job selling. He moved into management. He wanted more excitement, and so he started a company on his own, and he wanted to champion orphan drugs. These are drugs for conditions that are not huge, that it's not heart disease, it's not cancer. It's still serious conditions like epilepsy, but for the major drug companies, they're not big enough for them to make billions of dollars in profit. And just taking those orphan drugs, he built something from scratch, and he sold it for $900 million.
Incredible. Just incredible. And there are so many different points that you bring out. Now, let's talk about something relative to Jeff, and that is that money had to be put together for capital. And I'll quote right out of your book. The question was asked, how did you raise money? And his response was, I figured out who does what. I just focused on 6 or 7 private equity funds and 5 or 6 venture guys. Took a while. The market had blown apart. He had an advisory board, and because of that, had credibility, and was able to raise $150 million with nothing more than an idea. Now, this is so American. I was talking to someone this afternoon that I had a meeting with. We both concurred that one of the strongest things about the U.S. in the past has been the capacity of almost turning on a dime and becoming innovative. And there seems to be a pervasive belief that this is sort of non-existent now. I don't believe that. What is your positioning on that?
Donna, there's never been a better time for ideas.
And, I agree with you.
And, you know, there are, obviously, we've got problems. Unemployment is way too high, among other problems. But, you know, this is exactly where entrepreneurship flourishes, because it's because of those problems that people are going to work on solutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if everything is perfect, frankly, you don't have a lot of great opportunities for people to start things. It's because people see that there's something wrong, and that's what you got to work on. And my advice, you know, now to a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs is that these ideas that turn into hundreds of millions or billions, they all started out modest. None of these involved a cure for a major disease. None of them were where someone had to go off to a mountaintop to get inspiration. They all were where these people looked right around them and saw something they thought they could do better. And mm-hmm. And they sound so minor when you hear how these ideas started that it's just kind of amazing. And that's why I think one of the people I took, I thought had a wonderful quote in the book was Bill DeVille. He said, "We all try to avoid failure. And avoiding failure is not a way to get to success."
I agree wholeheartedly. You have to be willing, and that's typically what entrepreneurs are willing to do. They're willing to fall on their face if that's what needs to be done. It's okay, and then they'll say, all right, let me try something else. And it's not the wild, crazy Looney Tune that's doing this. These are people that are willing to work hard. It's very important. You have a man, David Becker, in your book. He developed the first internet bank. Talk to us about that. This is something that maybe some of my listeners have never even considered. What is it? How did he do it?
You know, it's kind of funny. I was in the Museum of Science and Industry. It's, you know, one of the most famous museums in the world. It's in Chicago. And they have an exhibit on the internet, and there, etched in this permanent glass and marble exhibit, there's David Becker's name, as one of essentially the internet pioneers. He did start the first bank, which was purely based online and internet, not a physical bank, and it was his third startup. He liked being in the financial services world, and he had a first company that he had, you know, what for most of us would be a huge home run. It was a $24 million sale. He went on to another company, and his third startup was First Internet Bank, which he still has. It's now at about $500 million in assets. But, you know, all of this stuff was from scratch. He was sitting in Indianapolis. It's not exactly a hotbed of venture capital there. He would still tell you that there isn't enough access to money there. And I think we got to take heart at that sort of thing, that those good ideas can flourish anywhere.
He also started something called Dino. And I thought, this is really interesting, because this man is very diverse as far as interests go. He seems to want to look for places where there are places of opportunity, where there are holes that nobody else is willing to look at. That seems to be a trait of many entrepreneurs. What is it that somebody wants that nobody's paying attention to? And then they go after it. Tell us about the Dino.
Yeah, it's interesting. He thought up this technology that would help a teacher teach and students to learn, so that as a teacher is going through a lesson, these are in classrooms that have some technology. If a student doesn't understand what the teacher just said, they essentially can indicate on the screen, and a yellow or a red light will go off for the teacher. And mm-hmm. if the teacher sees a lot of red or yellow lights, they know that what she just said, they didn't get it. And it's a fascinating technology to make learning more fun, more interactive, it's an amazing thing. He's still working on that one.
Well, it's just amazing. I really liked the two pieces of advice he gave you in this interview. He said, you're young enough that if it doesn't work, you can file bankruptcy and start all over again. Don't worry about it. And no matter how bad it gets, they can't eat you. And he said that came from his granddad.
Right. His grandfather was a rancher, and he wanted to be supportive of his grandson because David was going off and doing things on his own, and some other people around David didn't think he was quite right. And so, you know, he just wanted to be supportive of what he was doing.
Well, I just think that there is a lot of information in your book that makes for a fascinating read, even though it's regarding particular areas of industry. I mean, you don't have people that are involved in agriculture. You don't have people that are involved in the cosmetic industry or anything along that line. But these individuals, both male and female, really have taken on and achieved things that a lot of people would just say, gee whiz, aren't you lucky? It had nothing to do with luck. These people really work. Let's talk about Bonnie Baskin. I'd mentioned a quote from her earlier. Tell us about this lady. And, I mean, she's a multi-millionaire, actually. Maybe she's a billionaire now. I don't know. But let's talk about what she did, because she really found a niche. And, boy, did she go through some down times.
Bonnie's an amazing woman. She was a single mom raising two young sons. She was a researcher at the University of Minnesota, and she wanted to start her own virus testing lab. That was what she knew how to do. And so she left. She borrowed some money from her family and set up a van to go test viruses, and that was her start. She eventually set up two companies, one called Aptech and one called ViroMed, and the outcome for Bonnie was she sold those companies for $203 million. She is an incredibly inspiring example because she did this all on her own, and she just the way she learned from her customers was incredible. She had a number of stories in the book about just, you know, how she would get out there selling to these laboratories, and just the ideas kept coming because these customers kept on saying, why don't you do this? Why don't you do this?
Mm-hmm.
She listened, and that's how she grew the whole business.
Well, and there came a point when all of a sudden she wasn't able to get her lab work taken care of. I mean, she had some really, really critical situations that could have broken her. Just totally broken her financially.
Right. You're referring to the story that she was the contractor for the Department of Defense when,
yes.
You know, the first crisis over AIDS and HIV testing, it required that all servicemen and women be tested. She won the contract from the Department of Defense. Her specialty was virus testing. And she had a partner who was building the software, was building the information reporting system, and they completely fell down on the job. They absolutely did not deliver this platform they were supposed to, and she was approaching a deadline where she was going to start receiving 80,000 samples from servicemen and women all around the world, 80,000 samples a day that had to be processed.
Amazing.
And the partner completely fell down on the job.
Things happen. This is something she had total confidence in the capability of the individuals that were supposed to do this. They were not competent. They were not capable. How did she resolve it?
She scrambled. She had to find a new partner. She talked about an admiral, in the middle of the night screaming at her, and she just scrambled to find new partners, and they ended up having to do a lot of things by hand. In the software world, you would never think about doing 80,000 things a day over and over by hand. That's the purpose of software, is to automate something.
Right.
They did figure it out, but her short-term solution was to get a massive number of people involved to make sure that she did not break her promise, that she was not out of compliance with the contract. And she uses that as a great example that you know, she sees people where they can they have great ideas, but that you have to have this willingness to carry forward on the idea. And that's what you see from these founders. It's not that they have success after success. In fact, it's probably the opposite. It's that they keep on striking out. But their attitude to the strikeout is not, oh, I'm a bad person, oh, I should go home and stop doing this. They look at it like it's an experiment, and it's just, okay, that experiment didn't work. Let me go try a new experiment.
Mm-hmm. You don't give up.
No.
You don't give up. You ride the riptide, the tsunami, whatever it is. You're going to go through it, and you're going to say, somehow or another, we're going to come out of this with whatever is needed. This is my job. This is what I do. And I think that is what makes your book so very special, how they did it. Now, let's talk for a minute about Mike Blair. One of the things that he made a comment about, you ask him a number of questions, what it was that made the business Cyborg Systems grow. He said they spent a lot of time researching, trying to understand what value they were as a company going to bring to their customers. And one of their customers was British Airways. They talked to all kinds of people. They talked to the drivers, the CFO, the human resources person, the director. What was it that they needed from us? Why would they use our materials? This is something that's so very important. And in our world today, a lot of people are so disassociated from the interaction of people to people. He used that and came out ahead because of it. Tell us about Mike.
Well, you're right. That is his example, and learning so much from talking to everyone. There's another example in the book that I think is equally dramatic, Jim Dolan. Jim, at one point, bought a legal newspaper publisher. It was over 100 mm-hmm. years old, and most people would think, well, what's the big deal there? It's a newspaper. Newspapers are going under, right?
Right.
And as soon as he bought it, he had the staff. He said, we're going to go call every single subscriber, thousands of people. He said, we're going to call and we're going to find out, why do you read this? Why are you our customer? No one had ever done that before. And he found out something interesting. No one was reading this legal newspaper for the headlines, the front, the ads. No, they were reading it all for these little classifieds in the back that were reporting on foreclosures and bankruptcy. And he got an idea from that. He ended up creating an online database for banks and mortgage companies because he learned that it was taking them 3 months to find out when consumers or companies were defaulting. So from that little legal newspaper, he figured out from these customers what they were doing. It ended up that online service sold for $100 million based on something that he just had to ask customers, what's valuable to you? What are we doing that's valuable?
He said in 5 years, they had about 92% of the national market for public records used for credit purposes. That is an incredible accomplishment. And he gives credit to the team of people that worked with him to be able to accomplish this. The employees weren't dumped when he bought the company. He put them to work.
Right. He also had another funny story. You know, these are not overnight successes, and he said that when he originally got this idea to do more of, you know, what's called court reporting, to figure out from the court this information coming out, that high school teachers made great employees. They were just great researchers. They were very analytic. And so before they got it automated, that's how they expanded this to a national kind of offering, was they had a lot of teachers working on it.
Then let's talk about someone else that has used technology, Mike Domek, Tickets Now. He's also out of Illinois. And this to me is just absolutely fascinating, because this wouldn't have been, I mean, we all up here in the Pacific Northwest were familiar with Ticketmaster, et cetera. What made him think that tickets now could possibly be something valuable to people?
He, you know, it's so funny because in Mike's case, it was in his blood. He said that from high school on, he just loved sporting events and going to them, and this was like his passion, that at one point he figured out he could buy a ticket from someone who wasn't going to attend an event, and he could turn around and sell it to someone for a little bit more who did want to go. And for him, that was his light bulb going off. He was also funny because he said in the beginning he was just, you know, brokering tickets out of his apartment. He couldn't even afford a computer. He could afford a keyboard, and so while he'd be on the phone, he would just tap his hands on the keyboard, so at least he thought that his customers would think he had a computer. Now, he ended up selling to Ticketmaster for $280 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, when the Internet came around, I was going to say he was prepared, but in a way, he kept on practicing to be prepared. They knew the Internet was a new opportunity, a much bigger opportunity to kind of automate their entire sales process, but they had no idea how to do it, and they had to go through endless tweaking of how you would advertise, how you would build your market online.
One of the questions that you asked of so many of the people you interviewed was, what was their secret sauce? When you think back through the interviews, what is the most unique answer you got from those that you did interview?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll give you one of the answers because it was so interesting. Varesh Bhatia, he's the founder of a company called InstallShield. InstallShield is software that's now on every computer on the planet. It was a software program that hundreds of other developers had thought up. Varesh and his partner were in a 10-by-10 office, as he says, and they decided they would advertise. And they insisted with these computer magazines that their ads had to run next to IBM or Microsoft. That was the one thing they insisted on. So here are two guys in a 10-by-10 office, but because they were advertising and they put all of their money into these ads, everyone started assuming they must be big. Everyone started assuming, well, they must have something to do with IBM or Microsoft. And so that was their way to beat out over 100 competitors, and no one remembers any other software that's used to start up computers other than theirs. And that was the whole key to it, was deciding to advertise opposite the big guys.
That was the secret sauce.
That was the secret sauce, and they sold for $75 million.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there you have it. And there's so much more in his book, How They Did It, Billion-Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. And I think that this is so important because so many jobs have been outsourced to various parts of the globe. Millions of people in the United States today need work. We can make it happen in this country. These individuals have, and there are many more of you that can do it also. So, Robert, I would like you to give out your website so people can check it out and find out more about what you are all about and some more information about this wonderful book.
Well, thank you, Donna. The website is howtheydidit.com.
Howtheydidit.com. If you want to be inspired, you want to feel like there is opportunity for you, this is a book that really will give you that enthusiasm and that awareness. Sometimes what's perceived as the worst time is the best time to bring new things forward because there's an opportunity for them to be accepted, and we can make it happen right here in the U.S. of A. And for those of you who are listening from different countries, it can happen where you are too. That is what innovation is all about. Robert Jordan, thank you so very much for being my guest today. It's been an absolute pleasure. How They Did It. That's right. Billion-Dollar Insights from the Heart of America. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. So delighted you're able to join me today. Hey, if you'd like to have a free intuitive reading on the air, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of that intuitive insight. Give me a call at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. For those of you that might be listening for the first time, all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and of course, after that, let me tell you what I perceive. I always like to know where you're calling in from. And then when I'm finished telling you what I perceive, you're welcome to ask a question about anything that is of importance to you. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Tom Castrigno. We're going to be talking about healthy meals made easy. Oh, food needs to taste good. I can remember interviewing Jack LaLanne, and he said, if it tastes good, spit it out. And I thought, I can't live that way. I want my food to have a good taste to it. And that is something that we need to be able to get in our psyche so we can have delicious food and enjoy what we're eating. We don't have to eat cardboard and eat stuff that tastes putrid. No, that's not a requirement in life. And let's face it, too. We find food is really a joy and a pleasure. So we're going to be talking with Tom tomorrow, finding out about that. So have your pad of paper and pen handy. You may want to write down some of the recipes. Then on Thursday, we're going to be talking with Priscilla Long, the writer's portable mentor. Priscilla has done a wonderful job. If you'd like to be a writer, if you want to know what you can do for yourself, she has just this awesome book that you could use. You know, pick a section out, decide what you want to work on. It's really good. So we're going to be talking about that. And then on Friday, Mackenzie McGee is going to be my guest. This lady has put together an absolutely fascinating book giving you ideas about cycles of life. There are parables in this book, wonderful things regarding astrological information. I think you'll enjoy it quite a bit. I was really amazed at this book and how well done it was. So we'll be talking with Mackenzie McGee on Friday. Any other show information you might be curious about? Well, just tap that little button that says show information and you'll find a listing of all the guests that are coming up during this month. So I invite you to join us. I wanted to share with you a story about falling frozen frogs. Try saying that fast 5 times in a row. Falling frozen frogs. I am not going to try to say it 5 times in a row real fast because I know I'd make a mucky mess of the whole thing. Well, we're going to be traveling back in time to 1882, June 16th, when in Dubuque, Iowa, right here in the U.S. of A., hailstones and chunks of ice were falling. Now, there was a newspaper at that time called the Monthly Weather Review that said, the foreman of the Novelty Ironworks of this city states that in two large hailstones melted by him were found small living frogs. A lot of other ice chunks that were picked up by people contained living frogs. Now, these chunks of ice were between 1 inch and 17 inches around the middle. A lot of variation there. A few of the pieces were only a half an inch in length, and others were the size of a baseball. The biggest icicle that they found, this is all documented, weighed nearly 2 pounds. Now, the weathermen were really puzzled about this particular event. The objects really were not technically hailstones, but they were a conglomerate of very large hailstones that presented a sort of knobby kind of an appearance. They say, in their opinion, these pieces of hail could only have been created if the ice had floated or hovered somewhere in order to establish this unique crystallization. Now, the weathermen couldn't explain how the frogs got entrapped in the hailstones. This the only time it happened? Nope. 1864 in Pontiac, Canada. They had falling pieces of ice between half an inch and 2.5 inches in diameter. And at that time, these little green frogs, and they were all alive. They said the most extreme case of an animal enclosed in falling ice from the sky, it was recorded in Bovington, Mississippi. It was a 6 by 8 inch gopher turtle dropped from the sky during a hailstorm. It was entirely encased in ice. Fascinating things. Stranger than fiction. And it is the real stuff. Your imagination can go in all kinds of directions. Could there have been something like a cyclone type of effect that picked up these little critters, took them up into the atmosphere? It could have just been seconds and encased in liquid that then was frozen in atmospheric conditions? Who knows? Your guess is as good as mine. But it does intrigue the imagination, doesn't it? I love the stories of the unusual things. Just shows us how much we absolutely don't know. Donna Sebo here. If you want to give me a buzz at 888-815-9756, well, do that. And we're going to take your call, and I will be able to share with you my perceptions about what might be going on in your life. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz, 888-815-9756. I wanted to share a story with you, but before I do that, I pulled out some notes that Robert Jordan had put in his book regarding entrepreneurship. I had a conversation with a lady at lunchtime that I had a meeting with today. She's an entrepreneur. When we were talking, she was telling me how she had always been in jobs where every 2 weeks she got a paycheck. And she said, I did that for years. Now, this is a woman that is in her 50s at this time. So she said, I was very secure, and I had one job, and I'd had that one job for a number of years, and I got laid off because the company I worked for sold what they had. Everything was changed, and then I found another job with another company. I worked with them for years, and then I was laid off there because the economy became very, very bad. Well, she decided she was going to take the knowledge and experience that she had that happened to be in the marketing sales environment and put it to use on an independent level. What was interesting in my conversation with her, she did not seem to be all that comfortable in some respects with being an entrepreneur, yet entrepreneurship runs in her family. Her grandparents had, during the Great Depression, here in the Pacific Northwest, opened up a restaurant in an area where restaurants had died. But they opened up a restaurant, flourished, and were so very, very prosperous that in their community, now keep in mind, this is the Depression period. These were her grandparents. They were the only people in their community that had an automobile. That was a sign of wealth in those days. She said, I just happened to think of them when you started asking me about my background. Here this story pops up. She said, I had totally forgotten it. And yet, you're asking me the right question triggered that memory. I said, wow, what an inspiration. You need to write about this because you come from good, hardy, entrepreneurial stock. She said, you're right. I should write about it because it's a part of Pacific Northwest history. This is something that I think lots of times we don't realize, that we have stuff within ourselves, and maybe it could be in our family, maybe certain individuals can inspire us, or maybe we know someone that has dared to step outside of the paradigms of supposed security, only to discover that they're going to even do better on their own than could ever have been imagined. Well, my conversation with this individual was absolutely wonderful, and they felt so much better. They didn't feel as apprehensive about where they are right now in this point of developing their own business. Very skilled individual. This is something that we all need to remember, that we have talents and abilities. Yes, working for someone, that's perfectly all right. There's nothing wrong with that. But for those of us that dare to be different, that want to march to our own drummer, being an entrepreneur, stepping out on your own, not fitting the typical expected dynamic of paradigm, can be a little scary, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't stick your neck out and try. Let me share with you some concepts that Robert Jordan has. He said, too little funding forces discipline. All of these people that he interviewed had to deal with development of funding. Said the upside of having too little funding is that your business can grow organically and you'll stay very focused on making a profit and positive cash flow. Always have a standby investor. No matter how much you like each other and how much time and effort you've invested in negotiating and paperwork, large financial partnerships can, and often do, fall apart at the last minute. Another point, create a business plan that's a selling tool. Venture capitalist looks at hundreds of prospects, so your business plan has to be clear, credible, and able to demonstrate in 10 minutes or less. Hear that? 10 minutes or less, your dedication to solving a crucial problem. Be honest in all your dealings. Running a business is no different than running your life. Founders should be honest in their dealings and in their assessments. Always look at facts because facts don't lie. Start with what you have right where you are. If you wait for the perfect solution to come along, you'll never get your business going. Assume that the right tools, the right systems, and the right people will come along to refine it. Make your employees shareholders. When employees have a sense of ownership, it creates a kind of self-enforcement process. Give stock options to everyone at your company, all the way to the janitor. Owners think differently than employees. Fail fast. What doesn't work, throw it away. What does work, run with it. Knowing what's going right and what's going wrong and doing something about it quickly will put you at the front of your class. And the last suggestion is being willing to tweak your idea. If you fall too much in love with your idea, you won't have the capacity to take feedback from other people and from the market. The idea you start with is unlikely to be the exact idea you're going to win with. So those are further tips from Robert Jordan. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break in just a moment. When we come back, I've got a story to share, maybe a recipe or two, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But most of all, if you'd like to call in and chat with me, 888-815-9756 is the telephone number to call in to. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272. Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today, 800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. Don't forget, tomorrow we're talking food, so have that pad of paper and pen handy to take your notes. Du Bois, Wyoming. Now, what could an 86-year-old woman do that nobody else would have the courage to do or even the interest to do? What do you think about rodeos? Yes. Leota Dieter is a woman that really has a passion for the history of the Wild Wild West. She decided she was going to really, really do something very unique and special, and that is hosting a weekly rodeo. That's right. It's done weekly. This is when people that are wranglers at heart can develop and or show off their roping and bronc busting skills. And you know what? There's a lot of kids that like to get involved in this as well, and they end up doing stuff with sheep. She said a truly Western town has to have a rodeo. The same goes for what they have as a Tuesday night square dance at the Rustic Pine Tavern. Everyone in the community gets involved, and tourists just have an absolute blast. She said that she wanted people to understand the life and tradition of a real working cowboy who would come into town to have fun. So not all that long ago, really, when you get down to the bare bones of history. But this is a woman that you would never know is 86 years young and is doing something that's giving a legacy to a lot of people that maybe have only watched a Western movie. And here in Du Bois, Wyoming, they can actually experience it. Now, she said she really established roots in Du Bois in 1969. Her husband, who passed away a number of years ago, they had come in from Chicago. And her husband was a Presbyterian minister, and they opened up, when they came in to Du Bois, Wyoming, they opened up the Lazy Ellen B. Guest Ranch, which they owned for a good 24 years, and then they sold it. And she decided to sponsor living memorials in town. She developed a cozy reading nook in the library to the Bronze Cowboy and Cowgirl that was built on Main Street. And then she got involved with the project and the refurbishing of what is known as the Denison Lodge, which is an old log building from a dude ranch where Clark Gable vacationed. Ah, touch of Hollywood. Creates its own magic, doesn't it? And then she found that old log building, well, it would be a good idea to move it to the center of town. Guess what's happening with that old log building? That historical place, they moved into the middle of town. It now is where they host the Wyoming Shakespeare Festival. People come in and give presentations on the local wildlife, bird life, and all kinds of roundups. meetings are held in that building. She said, our dream was that Du Bois could help people see the relationship between the beauties of the natural world and God Almighty. A wonderful mix of people come through here, and they should experience what real Western life is like. If you ever doubt what one person can do, all you have to do is go to the library, pick up stories, books about people that you can read about that maybe are alive today or they have left a legacy of some kind that has impressed someone enough to write about it. It's so important, I think, for us to remember that we may have people in our own family or people that are next-door neighbors that have stories to tell that are just amazing. And I'll tell you someplace else. If you ever have a chance to do any volunteer work at a retirement home or at a veterans hospital, if you take the time to ask questions and listen to the stories of these people, yes, they may be up there in years, but if they have a good memory, they're going to tell you about experiences that they had, things that they've gone through mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually that hopefully you'll never have to go through, but they will give you a mind's eye view of their life, what meant the most to them, and what it was that they participated in life that made a difference. I'll never forget when I was growing up, there was a story about a man who was a teacher in this, well, a very small community in the Ozarks. This was a man who had a passion for learning. Now, he was never able to go to college full-time and get degrees, but he had managed to qualify to teach classes. This is many years ago. So to be able to teach his students, to bring them into the environment of understanding with the times that they were living in, he would sign up for whenever he could, whenever he could afford it, a class of one thing or another. He had been going to school off and on for years, never got a degree, until someone in the college administration found out about him, checked his records, and realized that he had attended literally hundreds of classes through the years. He had taken what he had learned back to his students, encouraging them to go on with their education, to open up their minds to new vistas. The college one day announced that they wanted him to be at a graduation ceremony, and they presented him with a degree that was meant only for him. And it was a degree that had been made up to suit him because he was a man who had taken so many hundreds of classes that he was a master of many topics. That was recognition by people of the community that saw what he was able to do. Now, in the history books, he may not ever be written up. But someone did take the time to find out about this man because he influenced the lives of hundreds of students. He influenced them because he believed in the power of education. He believed in teaching the children how to read, how to experience a joy for learning. And that joy could be passed along from him because he was living it. And until the day he passed away, you could always find him with a book in his hand, trying to find out the latest thing at the college that could be taken in the way of a course so that he could expand even more. He was a teacher all of his life. And you know what? That's what we all are. We are all teachers. And in a way, we're all masters, too. We're just in the process of discovering our own mastery. So if ever you doubt that you have value in this world, look at what it is you love to do more than anything else. I don't care if it's baking cupcakes or designing the next spaceship. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever brings you joy, if you want, focus on that. Learn everything you can about it. And then go out and give whatever you learn the best shot you possibly can. And in doing that, you will become the master of your own destiny. This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. We'll be back here same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. Have a magnificent day or evening wherever you might be. We'll be right back here tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.